What a powerful truth we just sang of, that even seeing the depth of our hearts, God still loves us. Do you think about this week, the worst moments you had this week, this year, to think that God's love is not changed by that is a powerful truth. About 18 years ago, I met Jen. When I met her, this gives you more depth of understanding of her character. I was a proud owner of a 69 Ford truck, kind of like this one. F-100, she still liked me. It's this massive hunk of steel, right? It had a straight 6300 in it, and even that looked tiny. There was all this room in the engine bay. I could literally sit on the inside of the wheel wells and work on it, which was really good because I had to do that a lot. And it had a this it was a four-speed, and it was an old farm truck, so the first gear was like really low-geared, and you'd go into second, and the stick was super long, so like third was way over here, and it was just, you know, kind of awkward to drive. One of the features of my truck was the passenger seatbelt selectively chose when and when it would not release. So Jen and I would be out together, and then we'd have to have longer conversation as she sat and struggled to get out of my truck for sometimes 15 minutes just to get the seatbelt undone. It had mileage in the single digits for gas mileage. When it got really cold, I would have to open up the hood, there you go, that's what that thing's called. I have to open the hood and wrap a small blanket around the carburetor and the air filter so that it would be warm enough to stay running or it would freeze up. I'm pretty sure that was dangerous, but I did it anyways. And although it came from the factory with a color kind of like this one in the picture, mine looked a lot more like this. In fact, it was worse than this. Jen can attest. When I had to write down like a description of my car, I would write it as rust with green trim. The passenger side of the truck bed had been hit at some point, so it was all caved in. The coolest thing about this truck was no matter how sketchy of a place I parked it, I never had to lock it. I never had to worry about it being stolen. And I figured if somebody did steal it, they wouldn't get too far before they were broke from putting gas in it to keep it running. And the thing about this truck is I would take it places that I would not even dream of taking my car as I own today because, frankly, I had nothing to lose, right? Who cares if it gets scratched, beat up, some of the rust comes off? And this truck illustrates this significant truth that as we begin to understand we have something to lose, it becomes harder to take risk. Give you an example, another example. I used to be a lot more daring in my adventures in the mountains and climbing and whatnot. And then I fell in love, and then we had kids. And all of a sudden, the math of what risk was acceptable changed because I had so much more to consider, right? It is, as we gain things, oftentimes it's harder to take risk. That's why, you know, sometimes the most dangerous person is simply the one who has nothing to lose because they can take all the risk in the world. When you own a rusty, beat-up 69 Ford pickup worth almost nothing, you take it places no sane person would take a nice vehicle because it's not going to cost you anything. You don't have anything to lose in doing it. Similarly, it's been said when we think about churches and organizations and groups of people that one of the greatest enemies of vision is actually success. I don't know if you've thought of that. When we started as a church some 50-something years ago, there wasn't really concern about what would happen to the building or what if we lost assets or what if we did this because we didn't have them yet. And as a church, as we began to have things to steward and have assets, the math kind of changes in our willingness to take risk. And in a similar way, many groups, many churches have started out with great vision towards something, and then they have success in doing it, and it actually tweaks their ability to have vision. For example, you might as a church decide we really want to reach out to men who wouldn't go to church, and so let's do a car show and see if we can get guys together. And the car show is really successful. And over time, you start to worry about keeping the success of the car show more than you do about reaching the men that you started the car show for. That's just how it works sometimes. As we begin to think we have something to lose, taking risk becomes more difficult. And so that's this reality that sometimes even success can be the enemy of vision. When we accumulate things, it becomes harder to take risk because we have something to lose. And since risk and faith are so similar, I think this is what Jesus is getting at. in a rather famous conversation that we'll look at in a few weeks in Mark chapter 10, when Jesus is speaking with this rich young man who comes with this question, how do I find eternal life? As the conversation goes on, we discover that this is a very religious man. He's kept the religious law quite well, and Jesus tells him he lacks one thing. Maybe you know the story. He says, go and sell everything you have and give it to the poor. Then you'll have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. And if you're familiar with the story, the man goes away sad. And Jesus turns to his disciples, who are pretty confused by this, and he starts to tell them how difficult it is for the wealthy to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, Jesus doesn't have anything against wealthy people. He's just stating this truth that sometimes our successes, our wealth, the things we accumulate are actually the very things that make it difficult to step out in faith, because we perceive how much we have to potentially lose. When we perceive we have something to lose, it becomes harder to take risks, to take steps in faith, than it is when we don't perceive we have anything at all. This morning in Mark chapter 6, we come to what is probably the most well-known miracle of Jesus, the feeding of the 5,000. And as we consider this, I recognize that over the years, I've often heard a question that in various forms, but it goes something like this. Do things like this still happen today? Is part of the question. And the other part of the question is, if they do, why don't I see or experience them as a follower of Jesus? Why is that not part of my experience as a disciple, as a follower of Jesus? We're going to consider that question this morning, but what I want to do is first sort of set the scene for what we're looking at exactly here in Mark chapter 6, because I recognize, especially for those of us who've been in church for some time, these stories become just familiar enough that they kind of inoculate us from really being impacted by them, maybe like we could. If you'll remember in the first chapter, Jesus invites these men who we now know as the disciples to follow him, and the first of them, who are fishermen by trade, to them Jesus makes this very fascinating promise in his invitation. He says to them, follow me and I will make you become fishers of men. There's something transformative in this promise. Jesus is saying to them, if you follow me, I will make you something other than you are now. I will give you the capacity to live in a way you don't currently live. I will make you something other than you are today. And as we go on and consider the gospel stories, we see, in fact, that these men have the way they see the world, the way they see the people around them, themselves in relation to God. All of that gets transformed as they walk with Jesus. And there's something so powerful in this moment about their view of Jesus and this promise, this invitation, that if you'll remember, what happens is these fishermen literally leave their nets, their livelihoods, things of great value, and they follow Jesus. This is not that different than the invitation to the rich young man, only maybe he had more than some fishing nets and some boats, and it made that decision harder. If you've been with us through our study of Mark so far, you realize that in just the six chapters we've been working through, a lot of really crazy things have already happened to these men who said yes to this invitation. They've seen multitudes healed. If you'll remember, they've experienced a terrifying night out on the very water which they've worked most of their lives, this violent storm, believing they're going to die, and then Jesus speaks and everything goes calm, and if you'll remember, they're even more scared because now they're dealing with this central question related to the whole Gospel of Mark is, who is Jesus? Who is this that even the wind and waves answer to him? Because if you'll remember the Old Testament, the only person who did that previous was God, and so they're wrestling with, who is this Jesus? And then they saw this insane, intimidating, and probably naked demoniac, right? Running to Jesus, this guy who was in such turmoil that night and day he was living in caves. People had tried to chain him up. He was cutting himself with stones and crying out. And they watch as he comes to Jesus, and he's restored. And in a rather uncomfortable manner, if you'll remember the story. He's made whole. And then in chapter 6, as we saw last week, Jesus sends out these 12 men in pairs with this astonishing task, right? He sends them out. By the way, these are men who still largely misunderstand entirely who Jesus is. They have lots of blanks still not filled in. These are men who are still failing to see people with the kind of compassion that Jesus does. And Jesus sends these 12 out in pairs to proclaim his message of the kingdom, to heal people, and to drive out evil spirits. Like, just saying that, that is nuts. Can you imagine experiencing that? Going from a fisherman to like, oh, now this is reality. Remember, that invitation was one of transformation. And yet, if you'll remember, Jesus doesn't just send them out. He sends them out with very interesting instructions, right? He says, don't take anything with you. No food, no bag, no extra clothes, no cash. If you remember, the only thing they can take is essentially a stick. Like, literally, Jesus says you can take a walking staff, but don't take anything else. And he sends them out to go village to village and to be dependent on God's provision through the people that they're going to be ministering to. I'm convinced, by the way, that Jesus sends them out this way to posture them for faith. He strips away everything so that in their obedience, they're forced to take risk, to trust that God's going to do things that don't seem really possible, that they're going to have something to eat, that they're going to have clean clothes to wear, that they're going to have a place to stay. Stripping all this away forces them into this posture where they can act in faith, and they're left with no other choice than to take risk and step out into the unknown if they're going to obey Jesus. So they have nothing to rely on, nothing to fall back on, just the two of them off on a mission in pairs with their sticks and their faith that God is going to provide as they're obedient. And so the scene we come to in Mark chapter 6, verse 30, I think it had to be electric. If you have a Bible, I welcome you to turn there. And I just want you to try to imagine the emotion, probably the excitement and the joy really summarized very quickly in a couple verses here, because they've gone out on this mission. And it says, the apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. Do you think that was just like, okay, and so then we went in this village, and then this thing happened, and then this other? No, they were like amped. Like, Jesus, you won't believe what just happened. And they're listening to each other and maybe talking over each other. And some of them were fishermen, so maybe they're trying to like outdo each other's stories. Who knows? You know, the whole fish story. It goes on, and he says to them, as they're doing this, he says to them, come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest for a while. And notice the background of this scene. It says, for many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. If you remember, they've gotten to a point where Jesus has these crowds coming to him in such a way that he can't go into a city without it being a problem. He can't go into a village without it being a problem. These crowds are everywhere. And we're told, even as these apostles, the disciples, come back to Jesus and they're in their excitement and they want to unpack everything that they've just experienced and everything that's just happened and tell Jesus about it and probably get some attaboys from Jesus, in the middle of all this, they can't even really do it. They can't even really eat because there's such a crowd. Again, I just wonder what this conversation was like. And we have this group of men who are probably exhausted, but they're elated. And they go to get away, likely to debrief further what they've experienced and certainly to rest. But notice what happens with the crowds as they seek to get away. In verse 32, this is how it continues. It says, they went away in the boat. And by the way, once you've read that story about that first storm, every time I think about the disciples getting in a boat, I just wonder, is there like hesitation? Like, what's coming next, right? We've been down this road before, and it was pretty scary. So they get in the boat to go to a desolate place by themselves. And it says in verse 33, now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. Now, who are these people? Many of these are desperate people seeking healing, right? And somehow these people are like charging across Galilee around the lake. Maybe they overheard where they're headed with the boat. We don't know, but there they are running on foot, if you can imagine sort of the crowd frenzy going on here. And they get there ahead of them, and it says when he went ashore, he saw a great crowd. They're there. They beat him. And he had compassion on them. And we could just read right by that, but understand, Jesus is tired. He wants time with his disciples. And there's this great crowd, and it'd be really easy for him to say, come on, you guys, haven't you had enough? Like, give me a break, right? And yet we read he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. So we have this scene set with this truly transformative experience the disciples have had as Jesus has sent them out. They've experienced things that seemed impossible. They've come back in their excitement, ready to share their experiences. They're exhausted, and yet there's this persistent crowd, right? essentially stalking Jesus and running along the shore to beat them to the place they're trying to get to be away. Out in the middle of nowhere, apparently, it's called a desolate place. I would imagine that the last thing the disciples want at this point is crowds. I would imagine what they really want is just alone time with Jesus to unpack and to process what they've just experienced. Clearly, their intention is to get away and to be together away. And yet, Jesus has compassion on these crowds who are following them. And he continues to take time to teach them, apparently into the late hours of the day. So now we have this long day, right? And as it gets later and later, maybe in a little bit of impatience, we don't know, the disciples, who again must be exhausted, suggest this plan of action, which is actually kind of logical. Verse 35, they see the situation. It says, when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place. In other words, we're in the middle of nowhere, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages to buy themselves something to eat. Now, this is a logical plan. I don't think we can fault the disciples for suggesting this. By design, they're middle of nowhere. There is no Taco Bell. There's no McDonald's. There's no Trader Joe's to go to and get groceries. So they suggest what's quite logical. They tell Jesus, you know, you should send these crowds into the surrounding towns and villages where hopefully they can buy some dinner and take care of themselves. This makes a lot of sense. This would be logical. This would actually make sense if this is what happens next with the gospel story. In fact, it appears that perhaps the disciples are actually growing and recognizing the needs of these people and maybe care enough to offer some suggestions, to take some initiative here. And although this story is familiar, I really try to hear this with fresh ears, because what Jesus says is absolutely shocking. It's radically illogical. It makes no sense whatsoever. What does Jesus say? Maybe you know the story. Verse 37. Jesus looked at the disciples. He says, you give them something to eat. You give them something to eat. This is really illogical. And they said to him, they're still kind of on the logic train, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? A denarii was a way of sort of saying a day's wage. It's like, shall we go spend 6 months of salary and just go buy a bunch of bread? Does that make sense? It seems really illogical. And Jesus says, you give them something to eat. Now, if you were to read down to verse 44, you'd learn something else about this crowd, that it's actually 5,000 men, because that's who you counted in those days. Sorry, women and children. So likely this feeding is a whole lot more than 5,000. Probably, you know, 8,000 is a conservative figure for this crowd. And let's just try to bring this to life for a second and wrap our heads around this. You know, when you want to feed a crowd these days, there's a go-to meal that you go to, right? Spaghetti, right? Everybody's been to a spaghetti feed. The reason people put on spaghetti feeds is spaghetti is really cheap, right? So just some math for you. Say it's 8,000 people. If you wanted to feed 8,000 people, you would need 1,000 one-pound boxes of pasta, okay? By the way, just try to imagine the pallets of pasta. Like this. Now we're getting into some logistics issues of like, how do you even transport this kind of food? So you need 1,000 boxes of pasta, and you'd need about 1,600 jars of sauce. And probably a really, really big pot, right? So it turns out even if you went to Walmart and bought this on sale, I actually did look into this, just that would cost you well over $5,000. Just to, like, the most minimal possible meal you can think of. And that doesn't take into account, like, preparing it and you know, all that. So the disciples respond probably the way I would. Like, really? What are you telling us to do, Jesus? This doesn't make sense. Do you mean we're supposed to go into town and spend the equivalent of 6 months' wages just to make this meal this one time? That doesn't necessarily even sound like good stewardship. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, I don't think this was a sarcastic response. And one of the interesting things about this response is it suggests maybe they actually had the resources to do this. Maybe they had the 200 denarii to go into town. I don't know where in any of these villages they would have found somebody that had that kind of extra bread around, because that would have been a really poor business model. So Jesus gives them this crazy instruction, and they've just come back from this amazing experience. They have this interruption of this crowd, and Jesus tells them to do something totally illogical, and they're trying to wrap their heads around it. Like, how do we access the funds to pull this off? It seems like a waste of money. They're, again, not responding as though he's joking. It seems Jesus is serious, but this just seems so illogical. I can imagine them looking at each other like, what are we supposed to do with this? And I don't know how much time transpires between these verses. I wish I did, because there's probably some fascinating conversation. You know, is this another test, like sending us out with just sticks? Like, just wait and see what we're going to do here? Maybe Judas is already counting what they have and trying to figure out the most cost-effective way, you know, to like feed these people. Grumbling about it. I don't know. Maybe they're looking around for another good idea. But I want to be clear that Jesus is quite bluntly expecting his disciples to do something that's impossible. He gives them a direction that is absolutely beyond them. They do not have the capacity to actually carry this out. Even if they went and spent the money, logistically going and finding that kind of bread and bringing it back would be not possible. But it's exactly what Jesus instructs them to do. Pause here. You know, I hear a saying quite often, and you probably have said it. We say it in church circles a lot. You know, God won't give you more than you can handle. Find that in the scriptures for me, would you? If you do a little research, you find out that that's sort of a paraphrase of something Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10:13, when he's speaking about idolatry and sin. Admittedly, the word for temptation could possibly mean struggles and trials and things like that. But in context, it's absolutely he's speaking about sin and idolatry. And this is that verse, right? He says, no temptation has overtaken you that's not common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. Somehow we morph that into, you know, God won't give you more than you can handle. But this is because of the next part. He says, but with the temptation, he'll also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. So the idea is actually that in context, that when you face this like deep desire to sin, specifically in idolatry, to walk away from God and worship other things, it says God will always provide a way of escape. There's always another option if you'll wait and look for it and see what God is doing. That's what that verse is about. I would say to us that it's just not helpful in any way to suggest to somebody that God won't give you more than you can handle, and it's not honest. Because the scriptures actually teach just the opposite. In fact, the issue is if you dare to follow Jesus, part of the deal is God absolutely will give you more than you can handle. That's called living in faith. It kind of requires that to happen. And if not just the Gospels, if you go through the whole biblical story, you will find again and again and again and again that person after person after person who is following God is asked to do things that are absolutely beyond them. It is far more than they can handle. Often they fail. Sometimes in faith they step out anyways and God does the unexpected. But I would encourage us, like, just remove that statement from your thinking. Don't speak that because it's not true. If you follow Jesus, I can promise you at some point God will give you more than you can handle. In fact, it's probably a regular experience, right? Jesus will invite you to engage the impossible. This is what faith does. And this is this risky reality of following Jesus that it may cost us everything, right? If you follow Jesus, I can promise you that you will face things that are too big for you to overcome alone. You will face needs that you don't have the resources to meet. They may be your own needs or your family's needs. It may be your neighbor's needs. You'll be sent out with what feels like little more than a stick sometimes, right? To do things that you know you don't have the capacity to do. But in obedience to Jesus, we're called to step out into those places that we know are beyond us. We know are more than we can handle. Notice something here. The disciples seem confused by this command. It's not logical. It doesn't make mathematical sense. But they don't refuse Jesus. They don't look at that and say, nah, try again. Jesus, we're just going to go rest. It's been a long day. Just send the people away. That's not how they respond. Again, I don't know how much time transpires between verse 37 and 39, but you know, sometimes the first step of faith is just simply taking a little risk and saying, yeah, that seems ridiculous. But like, let's just like be obedient to the part we know and see what God does anyways. Right? So where does this go? Notice what happens. Verse 38. He says to them, he asks a question, right? How many loaves do you have? Go and see. What's interesting is they don't go, yeah, we don't have enough. But they actually go look, like, which seems ridiculous, right? How is that going to help? Even if 12 guys all brought a week's worth of food, it's still not nearly enough. But they go and they look. They go and they count. And they come back and they say, hey, we got 5 loaves and we got 2 fish. What a silly task, right? Go look at your meager rations you have with you and let's just see where we can start. But they go and they do it. There's no possible way these guys could have enough food with them for their task. It would not have fit in their boat. It is not possible. And yet they go and they count. Like they take that first step of obedience in what seems ridiculous. Jesus instructs them to go see how much they have, and they do it. And this exercise, by the way, confirms that they have almost nothing to offer. They have 5 loaves. Think dinner roll more than like a loaf of bread like we think. So 5 little tiny loaves, 2 fish, very similar to tilapia likely, so not we're not talking like giant halibut here, like a couple little fish and some dinner rolls in this massive crowd. That's hungry. This is ridiculous. Jesus' instruction only confirms their total lack of resources and ability to meet this need. This is more than they can handle. God is giving them more than they can handle, clearly. It is now confirmed. They have some little dinner rolls and a couple fish. Now, most of us would end the story there, I think. I mean, we sense God inviting us to help perhaps a couple with these really tremendous needs. And so we go and we see what we have available help, and we go, well, it's really not enough. And so maybe I'll just throw my hands up, and you know, these issues just seem too big and too overwhelming. By the way, for those of you who work in social work and counseling and with students, I imagine you experience this all the time. Just you look at the needs of people around you, and you go like, I know I don't have enough. And sometimes we stop there, right? Or we just... maybe sometimes the easy way out is, well, I'll just refer you to this agency and hopefully they can help you. And often we do that, you know, well-meaning, but sometimes we do that kind of to pass the buck too. If we're honest, we might even have the resources available sometimes to help someone in need, but the cost just seems way too great, right? Like, we're just real. That's our situation sometimes. If we chose to, sometimes in very difficult situations, we could sell off enough of our belongings to take care of what otherwise seems like impossible needs. Now, whether or not God is calling us to that specific thing is a different issue, but sometimes we just choose not to use the resources we have available because it's too much risk, right? I mean, if you saved for years, it can seem like poor stewardship to spend a whole bunch of cash on one meal for a crowd. Like, in fact, in most churches deliberating about budgets and things like that, you would look at something like this and say, no way are we going to spend that money. This doesn't seem like good stewardship, right? On a bunch of strangers out in the middle of nowhere. So if you know the story, what happens next is quite astounding. And try to hear this with fresh ears and try to imagine the disciples and their exhaustion and this excitement and the stuff they can't wait to tell Jesus about, and then this issue in front of them and all the questions swirling and all the impossibilities. This is what happens. Verse 39. Then he commanded them all, this is the crowd, to sit down in groups on the green grass. And they sat down in groups by hundreds and fifties. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, so he took this ridiculous tiny little bit they had. He looked up to heaven, said a blessing, and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. That had to be weird. And he divided the 2 fish among them all, and they all ate, and they were satisfied. This is incredible. We get this further piece of information that they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. In other words, they ended with more than they began with. Verse 44, and those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. So again, probably a few thousand more than that. So with Jesus' miraculous provision, don't miss the fact that it is in fact the disciples who feed the crowd. I think this is a really significant part of this story because Jesus could have just done it himself. But I think Jesus was after something specific with his disciples here. And it's that transformation that he invited them into. Jesus could have, in a number of ways, I'm convinced, provided food for this crowd. But he does it in a way that requires faith in his disciples and obedience in the face of things that fly in the face of logic. And he chooses to work through them so that they experience being a part of this miraculous work of God. Again, when we consider these stories, by the way, just pause for a second, just try to picture this. So it appears they have baskets, right? 12 of them. So that suggests that each of the 12 went out with a basket. So when they went out, if you do the math, they had about a third of a fish fillet, okay, and like half a dinner roll. And they went out to these groups of 50 and 100. Can you imagine like looking down at the basket? Like, again, this probably seems ridiculous. There's no way this is going to work. And yet what happens? Something that defies logic. And God provides in a way that is astonishing. Again, as we read the stories, I think it's a common question that rises up of, like, why don't we experience things like this? Was that just this one time period that God chose to work this way? Well, first of all, I would suggest to us that we don't notice very well. Like, we don't notice very well when God's doing things, or maybe we try to just like explain it away, right? Like Monday was really cool. I got an email and then a phone call from Joyce across the street at the school. And she's logical. We were supposed to be collecting food, and she went out in the hallway where this giant pile of food was supposed to be, and there was almost nothing. And we're supposed to pack food on Tuesday night. She's a little concerned. Calls me up and says, do I need to start sending all my staff out to Costco to go buy some food so we have food to do this on Tuesday? Truth be told, we've done this 12 or 13 times now, and I felt that same way a number of times. But I had the benefit of walking through that and seeing that it just works out. And I've had those sleepless weekends wondering, God, are you going to make this stuff show up? So I encouraged her not to worry. I said, just wait and see what happens. And then we brought over your generous donations, and then Garden Way showed up with a few cars and started unloading them, and then some other people showed up and provided food. And lo and behold, we had about 5,000 individual items of food to give to kids, and we sent home 130 grocery bags full of food. Now, I don't think we need to explain that away. I think that's God's provision. I believe that. But we overlook it, right? Because we can explain it. I think absolutely God is at work in miraculous ways in his people. I think in many of us, the miracle is just causing us to be a little generous sometimes. And then just think of ourselves. I know that's true for me sometimes, right? And so part of why we ask that question, I think just to be blunt, is we're not paying attention. Like when we pay our taxes, because I hate to tell you those, it's coming due like, what, in less than a month, right? We do that begrudgingly rather than realizing, wow, this is like evidence that God provided really well last year, right? Like a big tax bill is actually something to be thankful for because it means there was income versus like a zero tax bill, right? And yet we fail to see things through those eyes quite often. But we don't connect the dots. And so part of the reason we ask that question is, again, we just aren't looking with the right eyes, or we're seeking to rationalize and provide logical answers for what's in fact God's provision. I think it's appropriate just to pause and like just celebrate. Like God provides. Like last week, we got to be a part of God providing for a whole bunch of kids who wouldn't have food this week to eat if not for God moving in people's hearts to come together and solve that problem. We should absolutely give thanks and recognize that is God at work. Amen? Like, can we be awake and realize that and say, like, this is good, right? But I think at least as often we fail to see God work in this way because we stop at the ridiculous question. We throw up our hands and say, yeah, there's no way it'll work. Like, that's illogical. We don't have the resources. That's just dumb. We don't even bother to check and see what we have because we know it's not enough. Or perhaps in some places, if we're honest, we're afraid to lose it. The risk is too great. And so we don't take that first seemingly insignificant step of obedience just to check and see what we have, right? And so we don't end up recognizing or having the opportunity to recognize God at work because we don't take those steps of faith and walk in obedience sometimes. What's interesting about this story is it's both a story where we see this compassionate Jesus who cares for the needs of the crowds, but it's also this compassionate Jesus who cares for the transformation of his disciples. So he involves them in something that is beyond them. Again, I think he could have done this miracle without their involvement, but instead invites the disciples to wrestle with the impossible, to step in obedience into places that just don't seem to make sense, so they can be a part of this miracle that Jesus performs. And as we continue through the Gospels, if you'll watch for it, you'll notice Jesus keeps doing this. He continues to invite his disciples into really sticky, difficult, illogical, confusing, unexplainable, seemingly no way out kind of situations where they can be transformed into people of faith. In fact, one of the central things becoming clear in Jesus' relationship with his disciples is that he's constantly expecting the seemingly impossible from them. Again, he just sent them out with nothing but sticks to go do things they don't have the capacity to do. And it worked. And now he invites them into this miraculous feeding. And we'll continue to see Jesus expecting of those who follow him things that seem impossible because he knows the resources that are available through God the Father. Jesus again and again tells his disciples to do things they don't have the ability or the resources to accomplish. This is a normal thing as you go through the Gospels. In fact, Jesus, I would say, expects his disciples to do the impossible through his provision. And in that process, what happens is Jesus is transforming their ability to see things in a new way, to see beyond the limits of themselves, to see these new possibilities in faith, to embrace risk and obedience. You see, friends, quite simply, I think it's often our own resources, our perceived successes that limit us most from being transformed in this way, that limit us from a different view of the world because all we see is what we have to lose or the impossible nature of the task or the boundaries of the resources we perceive are available to us. Again, I'll just say this. God will absolutely give you more than you can handle again and again and again if you choose to walk this life of faith following after Jesus. And I think the reason that's the case is it's the only path to transformation. That's actually how transformation happens. As people of faith, as we get placed into these impossible situations where there's no way for a resolution other than God to act, and as we experience that, our faith enlarges and it transforms us. I don't know if you thought about that, that dealing with the overwhelming, the impossible, the confounding, the illogical, all of that is actually the path to the transformation that Jesus desires for you. And yet, if you're like me, that's the stuff you want to avoid, right? Like, I want to see it all work out and the plan and the organization and all that. And yet, that's not transformative. Jesus invites us into this new life, this new view of the world, this new experience of God's love. If you'll remember again, the invitation to those fishermen was, come and follow me, and I'm going to make you something different. I'm going to make you fishers of men. You're going to be transformed. And it's these impossible experiences that Jesus uses to bring about that transformation that he promised. So as I consider that, that's really easy to say from up at the, you know, up here in front. But the question that I have to wrestle with, just like you do, is why do I expect it to be any different? That all sounds really good. But could we just play it safe and still have that? Like, could I just like accumulate my stuff comfortably over here and not risk it? Like, is that, could we just do that? I'd like that to be different. If we're honest, one of the challenges we face is, let's be honest, we are an affluent country. We enjoy wealth in a way most of the world does not. And one of the challenges that comes with that is we perceive we have a lot to lose in being generous. We perceive there's a lot of risk in loving people in radical and generous ways because unlike those who don't have anything, we have something we want to protect, right? That's just a challenge, if we're honest, that we face. But here's the thing. Jesus never promised that following him would be easy, comfortable, or without its scars. In fact, he promises just the opposite. And I would say that if, in fact, our experience of following Jesus is that it's easy, comfortable, and lacks scars, we probably aren't very close to his footsteps. Because that's not what it looks like, right? By the way, what follows this story for the disciples is another frightening night out on the water. Like, really, Jesus? Haven't they had enough? They go through all this. Maybe we could just like go have a party and celebrate all these people just got fed and it was really cool and take some time to unpack, you know, all the stuff we were actually going to do before this whole thing happened. Well, immediately after this, Mark tells us Jesus put his disciples in a boat, sent them towards Bethsaida. Well, he goes to pray and they get out on the water and what happens? Wind starts coming up, gets a little scary. I think it's really weird because there they are out in the storm. Jesus is in the boat with them. Jesus comes walking on the water. And they're scared. I think you and I would be too. That would be pretty freaky, right? What's interesting about that story, it's not only another opportunity to be carried beyond their own limits and to see, in fact, Jesus in a new light. The way Mark tells that story is really interesting. The words that Mark chooses. I said earlier, when you go back to that first storm story, it seems very clear that Mark is creating tension intentionally for us to wrestle with who is this Jesus, right? In fact, the questions are raised just earlier than this story, the last chapter, when we hear about John the Baptist being beheaded and Herod's trying to figure out who is this Jesus? Is he Elijah? Is he John? Come back to life? Who is he? This is this question. And so the way John or Mark tells us about this encounter of these disciples out on the storm and Jesus walking in the water is quite fascinating because he doesn't write this in a vacuum, right? He's writing this to people who have the backdrop of these Old Testament stories that they're very familiar with. And he uses this phrase about Jesus intending to pass them by. It's a similar phrase to when God was passing by in the Old Testament. And then what does Jesus say? He says, it is I, which is, again, a play on this idea of I am. And it's further bringing this wrestling of who exactly is this Jesus that these disciples are following him? Because he clearly seems different than the prophets and different than Moses, different than David. But in that story, Mark tells us that the disciples were afraid because they didn't understand about the loaves. That's a really interesting statement. It says they were afraid, like they shouldn't have been afraid. They were afraid because they didn't understand about the loaves and their hearts were still hard. And now I want to leave you intentionally with a couple questions this morning. And one of them is simply this, and I encourage you to go back to the story. What didn't they understand yet? What is it they didn't understand about the loaves? That if they had understood it, they would have viewed that whole situation at night out on the water in the storm differently. I'll just let you wrestle with that question this week. But there's a couple other questions I want us to consider this morning. And they really center around this question of as we consider this story of this miraculous feeding and the interaction of Jesus and the disciples this morning, as you don't just detach yourself from like a sort of academic exercise of unpacking the scriptures, but really like engage with the story. How do you sense Jesus would invite you to respond? What do you think you're to hear from this story? I'll just give you a few of the own things that came to mind for me. You know, there's a question, do I actually have too much to lose to act in faith? Like, are my possessions, are the things I hold dear to, that treasure here on earth, right? Like, is that becoming problematic for my faith? It's a real question for us, right? Like, to what extent do I just try to protect and accumulate and keep safe the things I treasure in such a way that it keeps me from acting in faith, from taking risk? How do I need to pursue Jesus in this transformation he invites us towards? Next week, as we talk about hope, part of the central reality of the gospel promise, the gospel story, is not just about what happens when we die. It's about this life we live right now and this reality that Jesus invites us into this new full life experience, not just someday, but now, in walking with him, in partnership, in what he's doing in this world, in restoring people unto God the Father. And there's hope in a life that's bigger than us, right? How do I need to pursue Jesus in the transformation he invites me towards to experience that life more fully? Is there an impossible need that Jesus might be calling me to respond to? That's a pesky one, right? Like, are there really big needs that seem too overwhelming in the people around us that we're aware of that maybe we just go, can't do anything about it, right? But maybe God's calling us to do something illogical, irrational, and to respond in faith. The other question that comes up is just, how do we need to embrace the world through this new set of eyes? You know, going back to that truck, how do I drive like I'm in a 69 Ford truck? How do I stay in that place in life that I'm not worried about it getting scratched up or banged up or stolen or whatever? I hold it loosely and recognize that whether you drive a 69 Ford truck or a brand new McLaren, right? I don't think there's one in the parking lot. Whatever it is, like, you hold it loosely. You hold it loosely. You don't let that keep you from walking in obedience and in faith. So how do we embrace the world through that kind of set of eyes? Let me pray for us. Father, we ask this morning that you would give us the capacity to live beyond ourselves, that you would give us the faith to step into things we can't handle, that you would give us the obedience to risk the things we treasure for the sake of others and for the sake of displaying your love. Father, would you give us fresh eyes to look at the very things we treasure and recognize where they control us and limit us, and to seek instead treasure in you and in heaven. Father, would you give us a sense this morning of the places you're calling us as individuals, as a church, that seem illogical, that seem impossible, that seem beyond us? Would you give us ears to hear your invitation to step into those places, to meet needs we're not resourced for by your provision and through obedience to your leading? Father, we don't want to be illogical people. We don't want to be people who simply mitigate risk. We want to be people who are transformed in the image of Jesus. And we recognize together this morning that requires facing into things that are beyond us and walking in obedience into those places that feel risky, loving people where there's risk, being generous in ways that'll cost us. God, would you increase our capacity to be obedient in those ways? We need you to be at work. All we have isn't much more than a couple fish and some dinner rolls. May we offer those things to you in faith and trust that you will be at work beyond us and our resources. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.